Ollie Double is the latest in my series of nostalgia interview guests, and Ollie, as well as being reader and drama and head of comedy and popular performance at the University of Kent, is also a stand-up comic, and he talks about his various experiences over the years. He grew up in Lincolnshire. He talks about why as a child he was frightened of Scooby-Doo and ghosts, and what his reaction was when he once had a Doctor Who book signed, get this, by Tom Baker. The conversation moves on to discuss the difference between one's public profile and one's personal persona, and as that applies to celebrities. And we'd learn about Ollie's nostalgia for the music of old TV themes. Ollie shares his thoughts about working in higher education, why he is an anti-hierarchical person but works in a profession which is quite hierarchical, why he is uncomfortable with unearned respect, why, like his students, he's on a journey just at a different level. We talk about the influence of pop music when he was growing up. For example, he remembers the Boomtown Rats on Top of the Pops. He talks about the Dead Kennedys and synth music. He reminisces about the time when he queued up in the rain and missed the beginning of Planet of the Apes. We talk about how The Omen made him rethink what he'd grown up believing in the Church of England. We share our experiences of going to see Jim Davidson on stage, which leads to a wider discussion about prejudice and politics. And we learn whether Ollie is a looking back or a looking forward type of person. So join me. My name is Chris Deasy, and Ollie Double is the latest of my series of guests in Nostalgia Interviews with Chris Deasy. Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have Ollie Double this afternoon. So you're the second person who works in drama here in the School of Arts.
That's right.
I interviewed Will Wallen recently as well. How long have you been at the university?
Oh, I've been at the University of Kent since the last millennium. I arrived in 1999. That's where when I started here. I'm kind of like the furniture now. I mean, they should put up a statue to me, you know.
Although, obviously, you work in an academic context.
Yeah.
Were you doing something else before you came here? Or did the stand-up come out of your academic
work? No, it's the other way around. I mean, I studied drama at Exeter in the 80s. And while I was doing that, I just became very, very interested in... I mean, I wouldn't necessarily have even called it stand-up then, but cabaret was the word that was used. I started performing that while I was an undergraduate. And then after I graduated, I sort of pursued it further. I moved to Sheffield to do a PhD. And, I started a little group of stand-ups. We used to put on shows, and then we started doing gigs in comedy clubs and art centres and pubs. And, you know, it became something I did eventually for a living. And then at some point in my life, I just decided that I just didn't want to do that for my living anymore. And so I moved into lecturing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny how so many of the people I've interviewed as part of this podcast series have themselves, you know, had a very different idea 20-odd years ago of what they were going to go and do.
Yeah.
But the way in which sometimes there's this fusion between the academic and whatever else it is that might be the object of their study. I mean, in my case, I didn't go to the cinema when I was really young. I suddenly started going at university, ended up doing a PhD on religion and film. But when I was very young, it was radio that was this big love. And somewhere along the line, that the two have somehow fused, not least in the form of this podcast. But it's funny how sometimes, you know, we can wear these multiple hats.
Yeah, I think I feel quite privileged in a way, because I think that one of the things having not done it for the whole time has given me is a sort of distance from it. Like, when I first started working as an academic, I found so many aspects of it weird, like the propensity to use jargon wherever possible. And of course, a lot of that's institutional specific. You know, it's like Kent will have a different set of jargon from the next university or whatever. So there's that. Also, you know, it seems to me that being an academic, what your job is, it almost doesn't matter what your discipline is. What your job is to step back from your first perception and to have a closer look, to look from a distance. Actually, that slightly sounds like a contradiction. To either look more closely or to look in a detached way at what it is. And it doesn't really matter. I mean, I think that's true in sciences. Let's say you're a physicist and you're interested in, I don't know, molecules and forces. And, you know, in other words, you don't just look at an object. You'd be able to assess its physical properties, its properties in terms of physics or whatever. Or if you're a biologist, you know, how an animal works or how a bee, you know, a biological entity works, that kind of thing. And I think that what's really weird about that is that a lot of academics don't do that for their own institutional working context. You know, they just accept that this is how we do things.
And sometimes when you apply that sort of jargon, maybe you think, well, because a question is worded in such and such a way on the NSS forms, if you try and feed that into your lecture so that the students will think, you know, in 3 months' time, oh, yes, I remember my lecturer talking about that, I'll therefore give this a good grade. It never works like that. There has to be an authenticity, I find. If I start using language that isn't mine, an alien language or a language that's very corporate, then everybody will see through that. So I think you're right. There has to be a sense in which you need to be able to step back and say, well, A, what's my passion for this subject? How can I best communicate that? Yeah. And if it's not in your own words, then the audience are not going to connect.
Well, there's an interesting thing. I mean, I think that I can't believe this isn't a major political issue, but in a time when we're sort of 10 years on from the financial crash, you know, the economy, our economy as a country, but I mean, I presume it's the same in other parts of the world, you know, it's stretched. So why do we spend so much of our national resources on auditing? So much is about auditing. We have the REF, the Research Excellence Framework. Nobody can even say how much money goes into that. We have the TEF now, the same thing for teaching, the Teaching Excellence Framework, and nobody knows how much that's going to be costing the nation. But it's an awful lot of money, an awful lot of money. And then you apply that to the health service, you apply it to the school system. Why is it so important to audit the shit out of everything in the public sector? And why does the private sector not have to do that? It seems to be entirely a waste of money. I mean, yes, it's true that doing the REF makes people do more research. But is that research good? Probably some of it is, and probably not all of it is. And then what starts to happen is that the tail quickly starts to wag the dog. So we start doing things not because it's a good piece of research, but because it's going to look good in terms of the REF. And that is so dumb. I don't think Kent's to blame for that. I don't think universities are to blame for it. But I think we're all kind of complicit in that. I think it's okay to play a game that you know you have to play. But at some level, you should be able to step back from it and go, yeah, but this is just a stupid game and it doesn't equate to real worth. I'll tell you a really ironic thing, if we're talking about language, really ironic thing about the REF is that one of the criteria for judging work is rigour. And yet those criteria are so unrigorously defined. Just rigour. Don't tell us what that means. Just put it, and then magic by magic, everything will be more rigorous. It's absolute bunkum.
Well, actually, this podcast series started out as an anti-impact thing because I was so sick of some, you know, don't get me wrong, illustrious colleagues do the most amazing research, but I would sit and listen to their presentations and think, but why are they doing this? In other words, what is it that gets them up in the morning? If I could understand that, that's what I try to convey to my students, you know, the passion for what they're doing, then there's a hook. But sometimes what's lacking is that, yes, you can see on paper how they might be demonstrating rigour or impact, but what I was trying to get out of this is, if you're going to be bought out for the next 3 years, if the students are not going to be taught by you, then what is it that makes you so passionate about this project? You know, is it just a generic thing, or is this something you've wanted to do all your life? And for me, that's, you know, the best radio interviews, or, you know, think of Parkinson on the chat show, is just that sense of somebody will say something and you just think, that explains it. It's like the Rosebud moment, you know, something from your childhood. And so I wanted to do this because I really wanted to get away from all of that jargon and say, but what makes you tick?
Yeah, I think that's a really noble project, I've got to say. I think that we should all be more concerned about each other as humans, ultimately, than these stupid systems.
Because there's the ironic thing then, that people have said to me, oh yes, but of course now that you're doing all these interviews,
it's great
course,
impact.
It's impact all over. And I thought, oh no, am I suddenly...
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because one of the problems with auditing is that it can never really measure the thing it's supposed to measure. What it's supposed to measure is, in the case of, let's say, the Research Excellence Framework, is the quality of research. But actually what it measures is the ability to play the game of presenting research in such a way as that it scores highly. And that's not the same as actual quality. And that's the problem. But any system you impose is going to make people, take game-playing attitudes towards it. And so it doesn't really work to do that. If you think about impact as an idea, it's a brilliant idea. I mean, the idea that we should be able to do research that has no impact on the world is ridiculous. Of course, everything we do should have impact. It should be helping people. It's a trivial subject. Drama. It's the arts, the study of the arts. Society could function perfectly well without that. But in another way, teaching people to. Or researching, how those things work and how they influence the way we think and how just technically in terms of craft skills and so on, how those things work is really interesting. And actually, I think if you can teach students to step back from a stand-up comedy routine and see how the comedian is using techniques to manipulate, I think they understand a lot more than comedy. Mm-hmm. So as an example, somebody like Boris Johnson, is one of the things that's so dangerous about him is he's got a really firm grasp of his public persona and he knows how to use it. And it allows him to get away with a hell of a lot. And he managed to come across marvellous, I'm ridiculous. And I've heard accounts of people who've been with Boris. And when he's been talking like a normal person, then he's had a phone interview in front of them, and suddenly he's like ruffled up his hair and he's gone, he's put that Boris persona on.
And I first came across him in the late 90s. Yeah. I remember he was always appearing on radio interviews, and it was almost like the joke.
Yeah.
That here was somebody who didn't sound like a normal politician because he sounded like a human being.
Yeah.
But he sounded like a human being who'd come, stepped out of a different age.
Yes.
But when he then became Mayor of London, I thought, this is a guy who really knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking in terms of what you were saying earlier about the sort of, corporate language. But the BBC did this. I mean, we all look back to the things that in the 70s, which would never be made today. You never get away with it. Think of all the eccentric people who populated our TV screens 30-odd years ago. But the BBC under John Burt became so institutionalised, bureaucratic, and it was using these metrics from outside, that you find it in the radio now as though all programmes are fulfilling a particular paradigm. I mean, look what happened with the Joe Wiley, Simon Mayo show, Drive Time on Radio 2. Then, the audiences were feeling, well, these two people have been brought together because it ticks a box rather than because there's a natural rapport between them.
Well, it's a classic thing that, I mean, Python, is this sort of genius, sort of iconic TV series. And Python wasn't that well received when it first started, didn't it? Get a great audience, not necessarily brilliant criticism, that kind of thing. You listen to the early episodes, the studio audience is silent through much of it. And it's only because the BBC allowed it to go to a second series and a third and so on that it became this enormous thing. Would they do that now? Almost certainly not. Mm. And that's just stupid. One of the things I should say that is I do feel very privileged to be in the job that I do because, I'm studying. In terms of my own research, I'm studying something that I find fascinating. And I'm teaching, a lot of my teaching relates to what I'm studying. I mean, I'm doing a project with some students this term about 80s alternative cabaret, and I'm writing a book about that thing. So they're getting, and we've got the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive, which collects material to do with the history of British stand-up. And so I'm able to, students are able to hold in their hand a flyer for a show that happened significantly before they were born, probably when their parents were about the same age as they are now, maybe even younger, and be able to do that is fantastic. I feel really indulged, that I've been allowed to do that. I think that's what's kept me in the job, really, is being able to do stuff that I believe in.
Yeah, I was at a conference a few years ago when there was an Australian academic who works in the area of religion and media, and that's his research area, because he works in a media studies department in Australia where he is not allowed, he can do the research he wants to, but he can't teach in that area. He's given a syllabus and told to go and teach it. So we all know him as this wonderful academic who writes these fascinating books, but he almost has to do that on the side. It's not integral to his job. So I feel such a privilege here that nobody, to be fair, has ever said to me, you can't write on Christmas, or you can't write on nostalgia, or can't write on film. And for that reason, nobody's put any pressure on me. I guess sometimes, there might be a pressure to say, put in another grant application.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's always a case of maximising the research that you want to do. And nobody's ever tried to, set me on a different path to the one I've taken. So there is a privilege, which I'm grateful for, because you know, I have the luxury of driving into work on a Monday morning and be really excited about the week ahead. I might not, you know, always feel I get done what I want to, but
yeah.
It's pluses and minuses.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah.
Anyway, let's go back just a little bit. Tell me a little bit about where you were born, when you were born, just to get a sense of your childhood and childhood influences.
Okay, I was born in the middle of the 1960s, in 1965, in Bolton in Lancashire. But I have no memories of that because we moved when I was a baby. So my dad was an education officer and... basically, I mean, that meant every now and then he would sort of move on from his, you know, from one job to the next, presumably to get promotion or something. And so they moved to Boston in Lincolnshire, and that's where I grew up until the age of nine. And then we moved to Lincoln, where I stayed till I left home to go to university. So, I mean, I have to say, I remember, I must have been at the age of nine, I suppose, having a dream about knowing we were going to move to Lincoln, having a dream about the big city we were moving to, and actually Lincoln's so small, you know. But in my dream, it was like vast with a giant sized cathedral that was sort of intimidatingly large, that kind of thing. Lincolnshire is really where I grew up.
Mm. Yeah, going back, because I'm from the big city, Cardiff, but I grew up in the suburbs, and I very rarely, it only struck me in later years, I very rarely as a child ventured out into the big city, certainly never on my own. And going back to my hometown, the part where place where I grew up until the age of nine when we moved house, was very revealing a few months ago because it all looked so small. And yet, you know, for me in those days, it was like, oh, we're not allowed to go beyond a certain street. And you think, but it's like a 20-second walk. You know, but when you're young, it's even just like miles away.
Yeah, I remember when we were still at Boston, I've got an older brother who's 4 years older than me. And we were both kind of into Airfix, you know. I mean, it's one of those things that he was probably more into it than I was, but because he was into it, I was into it. So there was a model shop, I can't remember what it was called now, but there was a model shop quite a long way from our house. I mean, we didn't live in the centre of Boston, so you had to walk quite a long way to get there. And yet I remember being allowed to go there by myself. I also remember being allowed to go to school by myself, which was a decent walk. I mean, I would say it's 10 or 15 minutes, but I mean, it seemed like it was longer because I was a child, you know, and there were all these different sections of it, you know, that you had to go over what we used to call the High Bridge, which had once gone over a railway track. I think the railway track was gone by the time I was using it. But like, it's funny because when my children were that age, I don't think we would have let them go that far by themselves.
Mm. What about very earliest memories? You've already touched on some of these, but what would you say particularly comes to mind from your growing up?
I remember, it's weird, when I look back at my childhood, it feels like somebody else's. It doesn't, but what I mean is that world that I grew up in doesn't exist anymore. You know, I was one of four kids. We were about 2 years apart, so we were kind of quite close. It sort of went boy, girl, boy, girl. My parents split up at a certain point, and so there's a kind of before or after moment there. And so, yeah, it's funny. I mean, I have kind of... And the other thing about memory is that it's like, how much is the memory of early childhood a sort of 300th generation photocopy, if you see what I mean? Like, how much are you remembering the memory, the thing, and how much are you remembering your memory of that thing? You know, so if I think of my earliest memories, I mean, I remember remembering this, if you see what I mean. So I remember being the youngest, and bear in mind, my sister is only, I don't know, 2 and a bit years younger than me. So that's a very early memory. I have a memory of being in the garage, I think it was probably a concrete garage in our house in Park Road, Boston, and playing with my older brother and sister, and thinking, oh, it's really nice being the youngest. And then I remember my sister being born, and I remember wanting to call her Goldilocks. That was a great name. The fact that she didn't have blonde hair didn't enter into it. I remember, again, I mean, all of these things are remembering that I remember. I remember my sister meeting my dad's father, my granddad, who died not long after that. He only met her once. I remember him sitting her on his knee, so visiting my granny and granddad and him sitting her on his knee. So I have very early memories, actually. And I have quite, I mean, I have quite a lot of, weirdly, I have a lot of memories of really trivial minutiae. So we had a, I think it was money box, like a plastic Yogi Bear money box with the paint chipped off, like moulded in brown plastic because that's the colour of his body, but like with the nose painted and the hat painted and things, but a lot of the paint off, the nose slightly pressed in. Like really thin plastic, like almost like not the, that much thicker than a polythene bag. So things like that, like objects that are in the house. But I also remember packaging. You know, like there was a type of chocolate spread that my brother particularly enjoyed, which actually I went through a phase of liking and then didn't like because I was quite a fussy eater. And sometimes you get crystallized sugar in it. And when you've got an unusual crunch that you weren't expecting, it's like, oh, what's that? But it was weird stuff because it was sort of like black treacle. You know, it wasn't like Nutella, which is sort of opaque. It was sort of transparent, really, but dark brown. And I remember them being very disturbed when they changed the packaging design. Like, why have they changed the lettering to have rounded edges or rounded ends? You know, what? Why have they done that? It doesn't. It's that's unfamiliar, and you know, things like that. I also remember really liking cartoons on television. And we didn't. We had a black and white set until I was way into my teens. But I liked the clarity of the world. Like, I liked the fact that everything was really clearly differentiated as opposed to live action. So, you know, especially for something like Yogi Bear, actually, where it's a very simple animation with very thick lines. I really liked that. But any crap cartoon, you know, like Scooby-Doo was my absolute favourite programme for a long time. In fact, the first time Scooby-Doo came on TV, I was too terrified to watch. I was really frightened of ghosts. So Scooby-Doo was about ghosts. And okay, it's always the janitor or whatever. But I didn't necessarily twig that narrative sort of convention at the time. And it was a weird thing because quite a lot of things that, you know, that I became passionate about, I initially started by being scared. You know, my first reaction was actually fear or suspicion. And then later, probably because I'd at once been frightened of it, it became my favourite thing. So I remember it being announced that this would have been still when we were at Boston, it being announced that there was a new series of Scooby-Doo happening the next week. It would have been announced at the end of the programme that was just shown that in the slot that it was going to be in. So I remember every night going, another day closer to Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, no, Thursday was always my special day because it was not just Top of the Pops, but Question Time. I mean, what, you know, it was almost like wearing multiple hats.
Yeah.
But what you were saying about fearing or watching something, it's about the numinous, I suppose, and it's sort of being inspired by something that also makes you frightened.
Yes, absolutely.
And I found that with Doctor Who.
Yes,
but also
same.
Strain of the Master, particularly. It wasn't the Daleks or the Sandman, it was the Master because he had all of those very human attributes, but demonically done. But even things like Trumpton or Camberwick Green, you know, when he goes under the ground at the office. Because I used to think he'll spend the next week, he only comes out for 5 minutes a week, the rest of the time he's living in a subterranean universe. When you're, I mean, I was quite young when I thought,
yeah.
At 24. But it's really funny what the impact that has. And I was talking to somebody who was at a previous job I had, as a colleague who taught children's psychology, and she was saying how wonderful the Teletubbies was. And it seemed so incongruous to me because my adult self, I just thought, well, you have like what was like an embryo in the sun.
Yeah.
And actually, I thought that was quite spooky. But my own children, although 20 years since Teletubbies was made, absolutely gravitate towards it. And they know all the characters. I haven't got a clue who Tinky Winky is or Iggle Piggle or something else.
Strangely enough, I used to know, well, I still do slightly know, both the original Tinky Winky and Dipsy, because they're both on the comedy circuit. So Dave Thompson was the original Tinky Winky. He was replaced at some point, though he didn't do the voice, just the you know, the skin work, as it were. And John Simmet is Dipsy, so yeah. Well, Doctor Who is, I mean, it's the exact same thing with Doctor Who. I mean, I've been a fan since I was, I don't know, how I do now, actually, if I think about it. Probably seven. So I think the first one that I watched was The Sea Devils. That was definitely the first one I watched. And I tried to watch it before that and had to run out of the room. I tried to watch it when Patrick Troughton was
the Doctor. I was going to say, was it Troughton or Pertwee?
No, I tried to watch it when Troughton was the Doctor. I really like the Troughton stories, actually, but it was just too frightening. And in fact, I have a memory of trying to watch it with Troughton, and there was a doll that came to life. But I know that's actually a Pertwee story, so I think I might be confusing memories. I started watching it. It was, I think, the Day of the Daleks had just finished, and then the Sea Devil started. And I was like, maybe I shouldn't start now. It's the first one of a new adventure. Maybe that's even too scary. They went, no, but that's a good place to start. And it was one of those things where I'd watched the first episode. This is my favourite thing. And, you know, I've got a photo at home that was on the front of the Lincolnshire Echo of me getting my Doctor Who book signed by Tom Baker. And I tell you what, right, so this would have been, I think, 1975, something like that. It was the Android Invasion was the story. And he came out. We were all really excited. I was quite near the front of the queue. Got there really early with my pile of Doctor Who books to sign. And he came out from this back room in Lincoln Woolworths. And he did his toothy, you know, trademark toothy grin. He took his hat off. He was in the full costume. And I remember hearing this enormous cheer and then realising it was coming from me. Like, there was no volition there, no conscious control. It was just from deep in the pit of my stomach, this enormous cheer came out. Like, it never had anything like that level of excitement any other time in my life. And, and he signed, I think I probably took two or three books and he signed them all. And my friend Marcus went back at the end of the day and took his entire collection of Doctor Who books and apparently signed all of those.
Because when you meet your heroes, sometimes they can have a very different effect. And I've been in that position when you meet somebody who you revere, maybe a film star or director or somebody involved in the industry. And then you meet them and you think, actually, they're not as special as I. The pedestal that I put them on actually is, you know, I've always seen them through my eye, you know, in their own right. When they're off screen, they're just ordinary people who think it's a bit weird that people would come up and know more about them than maybe their next door neighbours would.
Yeah, I had a weird experience like that, actually, which is that I know Ross Noble a bit, and because he used to play our comedy club in Sheffield in the 90s, and in fact I first met him when he was 16, and he was okay then, but then I met him again when he was 18, and his act had become really like it is now, like incredibly improvisational, extraordinary thing. And I hadn't known that he was 16 before. So then when I realised that he was now only 18 and a genius, that was kind of amazing. But then when I moved into academia, like a lot of people I knew on the circuit, I lost touch with, you know, I sort of, you know, worlds drifted apart, that kind of thing. And then when I wrote a book in the mid 2000s, I got back in touch and I did an interview with him, and it was really weird because he'd become famous in the intervening period. So I felt like I was meeting two people, the person I used to know and then this public person, you know, that layered on top, this public, not even persona, it's like an identity, a level of fame, a status that had kind of grown up. And It was a sort of an odd thing, really. I mean, I think, you know, you have to bear in mind that, you know, this is sort of taps nicely into my research. I'm very interested in that thing of the problem of identity on stage. Who is that person we see on stage? I'm not talking with acting, where it's fairly clearly defined. You know, we know that it's not really the Prince of Denmark, it's somebody else. But with stand-up, you don't know how the Harry Hill you see on stage would relate to the Matthew Hall you might meet off stage. I had a weird one with that, actually. That was in Whitstable. And Harry/Matthew has a house somewhere near there. And I'd seen him like 2 days before doing a television record. And then I met him in the street, but he wasn't wearing the Harry Hill suit. And he had a hat on and stuff. And he just said hello. And it took me, I don't know, 20 seconds? No, but probably not as much as that. It felt like an hour. And then the penny drops. I went, oh, bloody hell. And, you know, we had a chat. But it was really weird because it was like that distance between the public persona and the private person was really kind of brought into sharp focus. I felt a bit embarrassed that I didn't instantly recognise him. Because it's like I met him numerous times, you know, outside of that.
Because sometimes, particularly with radio, which can be a very intimate medium, perhaps less so now with the Zoo format that seems to be so much the rage. But growing up for me, I remember Radio 1 waking up very early, Adrian John, and then you'd have the Radio 1 breakfast show. And it was always just one person in the studio with the records and reading out dedications, and I always felt I got a real sense, you know, I got to know that person.
Yeah.
But of course, in later years, with all the various allegations made about people in that very profession,
yeah,
sometimes you thought, well, actually, maybe we didn't really know them. And it's made me revisit that and think, well, I felt that I connected in some way with their radio persona. But of course, I always imagined that that radio persona, was, you know, they were just coming into the studio, doing their programme, and then they were the same person a lot of the time. And it was quite heartening, actually, to read Johnny Beerling's autobiography, talking about the time he was controller of Radio 1, and he referred to Tony Blackburn. I think they'd had a bit of a falling out in later years, but he said that, you know, what you hear and what you see on air is also what you see off air. And he said that he couldn't say the same thing about certain other colleagues like Jimmy Savile. But for me, that gave me some heart, that when I thought there was an authenticity there, and I think that's what I listen to the radio for, yeah, the sense that there is, you know, I'm giving up my time for a stranger to come into my car or my living room, and it has to be sort of both two-way. Same with these interviews, I guess. If I don't give away something about myself, well, why would I be doing this series? There has to be something interactional and dialogical.
But I think one of the things about persona is that, I mean, to put it very simply, it's about selection and amplification. So in other words, you know, if you've just had some really bad news, but you're contracted to perform an hour of comedy, you know, generally speaking, you're not going to spend an hour sharing your woes. You've selected, I mean, for a start, you've got your material anyway. Stand-up isn't just improvised. Most of it's sort of at least structured a bit. But so what you do is, as you develop your act, you kind of take the bits of yourself that you think work. I mean, consciously or unconsciously, is what you're doing. And you're kind of more or less, you select the bits of yourself that you put onto the stage, and then you kind of amplify them a bit normally, exaggerate them a bit. And even if you're not aware of doing that, that's kind of what you're doing. And I think that what's interesting is when there's a kind of disjuncture, an obvious disjuncture between the private person and the public persona. So I think somebody like Louis C.K., this whole thing with him, the American comedian, where, you know, he's confessed to this sexual misdemeanors, you know, where he's been masturbating in front of women without necessarily their consent. Now, the thing about that is, for a start, there were rumors for a long time before he actually outed himself, and he kind of denied it. The second thing is, whatever a genius he is, his particular genius is self-revelation, is scathing honesty, like you know, scathing self-criticism. But then if you discover there's this whole area of his life that he was not being honest about. I mean, people have said, oh, well, you know, he was leaving the clues of his stand-up. He talked about masturbation a lot. But he sure as hell wasn't confessing to that. I don't know how he can come back from that. I know he has done appearances in New York since, you know, in the last few months. But I mean, I think there's two questions there. One is ethical. You know, is it right that you should be doing this? Because, you know, given what we know about you. Well, that's a complex one. But secondly, sort of related to that, but it's not the same question, will an audience accept it? And I'm kind of amazed in a way that an audience will, because I kind of go, yes, but what about this gigantic elephant that he brought onto the stage with him? Not only an elephant, but a really, really unpleasant one that you know, could quite easily trample somebody. Like that. I had a bit of a kind of personal dilemma on that, because I used to include a clip until last year of Louis C.K., and I knew that there were allegations, but I also knew they were unproven and he hadn't confessed to them at that point. And I sort of thought to myself, should I leave that in the lecture? And at the end of the day, I said no, because it's within the way it's sort of, you know, configured within the lecture, is that it's about brutal honesty. And actually, I'd have to do the whole lecture about that. And actually, why not put, for example, a female comic talking very honestly? So as it happens, there's an excellent female comic who I used to teach here, Laura Lex, and she's done this show about mental health, about her own issues with well, very particular thing, but, you know, touching on mental health. I thought, well, why not put a clip of Laura in? And that seems like a nice way of sort of sorting the problem out. Not only have I got rid of this problematic example, which, yeah, I'm not saying you shouldn't consider it, but I'm saying that if you're going to consider it, you can't ignore the frame of that issue, which would then unbalance things. Or do you actually improve the gender balance in the examples you're given, and, you know, celebrate the work of a former student? It was a fairly easy decision, really.
Yeah, and I've got clips that I've been using with my students for years, for example, from the film American Beauty, but now I feel very uncomfortable using it for obvious reasons. And this does arise though sometimes, doesn't it, where you're dealing with material and you don't quite know the context, or at least the context in which you're using it, of course, might be read in lots of different ways, and that's why I'm sometimes quite wary, you know, if I'm doing stuff with students, that they may actually apprehend whatever it is that's up there on the screen very differently to what I'm getting out of it, and I'm always worried that they might then come back and say, actually, we were pretty freaked out by that.
Yeah, I mean, I left a Woody Allen clip in another lecture, and I did think about it, and I thought, well, first of all, that is unproven, that's contested, and I've read fairly convincing things on both sides of that argument, and so there was that. Then, in addition to that, this is not a good reason by itself, but it is genuinely difficult to find a better example of what I'm talking about with that clip. And at the end of the day, he was a genius stand-up. Now, that's a problematic thing, because it's one of those things. I don't think anybody's got a convincing solution to this dilemma, which is, can something produced by an awful person have merit? You know, can we consider it without considering the awful person? And you might say, oh yes, we can, we absolutely can, there's a separation there. Well, okay, but I mean, I don't know, if Hitler had been a brilliant painter, would we be exhibiting his paintings? I don't know whether we would, to be honest.
And a colleague of mine a couple of years ago said that about Rolf Harris. He said, but at the end of the day, he was a very good artist, or we enjoyed watching him. And of course, how can you remove that from your psyche?
But I think the difficult thing when it comes to something like Rolf Harris or you know, Louis C.K. or whoever, the difficult thing is that it's such a personal expression. I mean, much more so than literature, because it's not only that the person is, well, for a start, the person is often talking about their own life. In addition to that, it's them talking about it, and they're pretending to be just who they are, if you see what I mean. Their persona is based normally at least a bit on themselves. So, you know, it couldn't be, like, it's really difficult to separate that. And I think the Louis C.K. is an interesting one, is an interesting example of that, because, you know, like, well, you know, if your USP, as it were, to put it cynically, if your USP is brutal honesty, and there's this massive thing that you've not been honest about, then how does that act now work?
So I remember when Jonathan Aitken was on Have I Got News For You?
Yeah.
And he was on the team with Ian Hislop, and you just knew he was going to be slaughtered.
Yeah, yeah.
And Hislop, from the very outset, raised this issue and said, you know, all the hypocrisy. And there was a pause, and Aitken just said sheepishly, yeah, sorry about that. And that was it.
Yeah.
And of course, in a way, Hislop no doubt had all these lines, and he was going to really hammer him.
Yeah.
But the guy had apologised, whether he was contrite, and almost. Yeah. But it felt as though there was a lot more going on, and this was awkward. And of course, after that, he probably did. whether this was Aitken being very clever and knowing that, you know, it's better to come, you know, have, rather than be defensive all the way through it and be attacked, he kind of sort of played it in a different way. And Hislop sort of, you know, just sort of thought, well, was that an apology? And you could see him almost sort of like frustrated, but also the guy had apologised, and the word, whether you believe that he was contrite or not, the word sorry came out of his mouth, and I don't think Hislop was expecting that.
Yes, it's almost a sort of it's a like dealing with a heckler or something, you know. Mm-hmm. there's a game element to it, and I think if you are, you know, if you sometimes making a public apology, yeah, it's very disarming, actually. Because actually, politicians are always, a lot of political debate is like the yes-no game, isn't it? It's like the interviewer knows what the person's not allowed to say. They'll repeatedly ask them to say that thing, and the person will find increasingly creative ways of not saying that thing. It's not very edifying, really. But I mean, you know, there are ways around. I mean, there was quite an interesting one. I mean, this is somebody, again, who probably, you know, sort of people's view has changed of. But I mean, Ken Livingston, when he said, when he was going to run for mayor of London and he didn't get the Labour nomination, he promised that he wouldn't run, and then he did and was elected, somebody put it to him that he'd said that he wasn't going to run. He said, yes, I lied. And it was kind of brilliantly honest, like most politicians wouldn't do that, you know. So the way that people kind of negotiate those kind of things is very interesting and counterintuitive as well.
But there was something. But of course, then in those days as well, politics often wasn't anything like as polarised as it is now, and people didn't even vote. So they say, "Oh, it's all the same." You know, whether you vote left or right, they're all, you know, politics is very much in the middle. So there's been changes on lots of levels. But there's a part of me that just wants to go back and say, before social media as well, what were the journalists covering? What was the BBC covering? What did an average news bulletin sound like back in, say, the early 1990s?
I'll tell you one thing that it sounded like, not in the early 90s, but go back to when I was a kid. It's a really weird thing. It's like Doctor Who. In Doctor Who, when you look at the 70s Doctor Who, it's the past's idea of the future. So, you know, computers don't look like computers, right? They look like a, I don't know, like a wardrobe with lights on and switches, very analogue. But the same is also true of the texture of radio, because the PM, do you remember they used to have a really synthy kind of, I'm not talking 80s synth, I'm talking proper hardcore 70s synthesized BBC Radiophonic Workshop. It's amazing. I love to hear that music from that time because it really brings it all rushing back.
On the PM programme?
On the PM programme,
so in the days of Valerie Singleton used to do it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't remember about the presenters. I remember the music. It was kind of scary. It was scary music. It was like the, you know, the Doctor Who thing.
I have to say, I'm thinking back to the 6 o'clock news, and it was very, I mean, it went on until 93, but the old
that was a good one as well.
It was like Doctor Who. In fact, actually, if you listen to the Doctor Who theme in that, and you have all the different images flashing on the screen, and there'd be, oh, it was the old 9 o'clock news with a map of the country, and everything was coming out of London, and it looked like suddenly the aliens had landed and, you know, decimated the capital city. But I almost felt I should stand up watching that. It was very exciting at 6 o'clock, never replicated since.
Theme tunes are great for nostalgia. I mean, the old BBC News theme, which was like multiple rhythm tracks. There wasn't really any melody. You can't really sing it because it's all drums and different. But like, it was so exciting. You know, you just, oh my god, the news! It's the, I mean, I'm never excited by the news. I didn't really like it at that age. But
For me, certainly from the age of 15 or 16 onwards, the 6 o'clock news. I used to even record it sometimes, and it was exciting. You know, the 6 o'clock news with Peter Sissons and Jill Dando, and then you'd see that in the background, and then you'd have to wait 6 minutes before Jill Dando came on because Peter Sissons, you know, read out the headlines and the story. Yeah. But there was something in that because it happened every evening. But somehow, now, you know, these days, I mean, look, I get all my news from the BBC, but online, and I don't watch the TV news anymore because, of course, I can short circuit and go to the stories I want to read. Yeah, but I would always sit through the entire bulletin, maybe even make notes sometimes because there wasn't. No social, yeah, CFAX, I suppose.
CFAX, yes, the hilarious kind of like Neanderthal internet.
Yeah. It was, but we all grew up on it. It was funny, wasn't it?
Yeah, with all that kind of blocky pixel art, which is now kind of cool in a weird way. Yeah. You know, I mean, my kids, their idea of nostalgia, I mean, they're in, I mean, Tom's 19, Joe's just turned 22. Their idea of nostalgia is Space Invaders and things like that. Whereas, you know, for me, that I mean, that's before their time, but somehow they. It has that idea of the exotic, just before my time thing, kind of thing. But yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, I like the things that bring it back for me are things like, theme tunes or graphic design things, you know, album sleeves, amazing, especially early independent singles, you know, like where they've actually just got a typewriter and typed the lettering and then photocopied it, and there's a photocopy of a photo. It's all kind of degraded. It's probably just black ink on white paper, or maybe there's one other colour in there. Mm-hmm. I find that kind of thing incredibly exciting. The roughness of it, the homemade quality of it. Whereas now, I'll give you an example, actually. Comedy Club, when you look at Comedy Club publicity material, I think a lot of it's awful now. It looks really professional because it's really easy with, you know, publisher or whatever to put together something that looks, or Photoshop, to get something that looks really professional. But I just think it's the lack of imagination. So, you know, a really generic Comedy Club poster will just have bubbles, and each bubble will have a headshot of a comedian that's been sent to the you know, the promoter. And then it'll say, you know, funny, you know, Mr. Funny's comedy hour or something. That's the, you know, it's really generic, right? We've got, you know, publicity material from the 80s, from the alternative cabaret scene. And, you know, it'll be called the Meccano Club, and which already is quite kind of interesting. Or the Hellfire Club, you know, it'll be already an interesting name. Won't just be called Chuckle Time Laugh Club or whatever. And then the poster will be done with paint and photocopy and handwritten lettering and badly applied letter set, right? And but it will be full of imagination. So there'll be an image of a kind of film noir type of woman in a white spotlight with, you know, handwritten lettering around the edge, and you know, it's there's something like that is so attractive to me. You know, the homemade quality, or it'll be screen printed, it'll be all these figures in gas masks and things. You know, it's like when it was still, when comedy was still really a branch of punk in a way. You know, that it's the same sort of aesthetic, the visual aesthetic. That all that stuff really brings it back to me, and it's quite interesting how when people actually fake that using digital media, myself included, you fake that style, that analog style, because there somehow feels like there's more imagination and authenticity in that than the little bubbly headshots.
What about when you were at university? What did you study? I should have asked you that earlier on.
I studied drama at Exeter, and it was a fantastic transformative experience. I think it will have changed an awful lot. I was one of 8 single honours drama students at the time, and we had fantastic resources, and we had a fantastic staff, and it was so creative. And go back to the thing about not being institutionalised. How about this? Get this. Imagine this getting past the modern higher education system. We had no fixed curriculum. We had two we had a core module, which was core across the School of English or whatever it was. So it involved bits of film, bits of English, bits of drama, which in all honesty wasn't very good. We also had to take a kind of subsidiary course. So I did one on film, which was okay, but it was very good for me. But I mean, I didn't particularly enjoy it at the time. And then the rest of it, the entire thing was taught in projects, half a term per project. Terms are 10 weeks long. So we're doing a project on, let's say, agitprop, or we're doing a project on commedia dell'arte. And in that project, you would do lots of research and you would do lots of workshops, and there was no fixed timetable. It changed every week. You'd get it announced on the Friday and you'd turn up the next week. We had great contact hours, and it was really instinctive. It was really, I mean, from the staff and the students, I don't know what other people felt, but I think this was a kind of common perception. We felt like we were on the same team as the staff. It didn't feel like the them and us thing. We used to go for a drink with them sometimes after the class, that kind of thing. But it also felt like we were engaged in the same project. They made us do a Brecht and Weill opera, for God's sake. You know, they filled the studio with sand and brought a defunct car in by turning it on its side and moving it round the back to the loading doors. Kind of building site polythene sheets to represent skyscrapers. They made us do this extraordinary stuff. I mean, way beyond our capacity in many ways, way beyond our capability. But it was utterly transformative. I changed. I remember going home, distinctly remember this time of year, actually, going home just before Christmas, going home for my first vacation and feeling and sort of, you know, talking to my relatives and feeling like I was a different person from the person who'd gone away in early October. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah, university for me completely changed my outlook on the world, because for the first time I was autonomous, but it was a question of what I then did with that autonomy. And, you know, we didn't have but I'm the senior tutor here, so of course if students don't go to their lectures, then I'm the person who needs to tell them off. But we didn't have registers taken in those days. The staff didn't necessarily know our names, and yet we all went. I say all went, that's absolutely not true. The people I saw at graduation was like, who are you? You know, you have the same degree as me. But generally, we used to go and we do some amazing, you know, out of those classes, the most incredible friendships would develop.
Yeah.
So it was the academic hub would then facilitate, you know, a wider sense of social. You know, I was in a very sort of small West Wales university, so community mattered a lot because we were really cut off. There were no big cities, there were no great distractions, but it was a very people centred university. It sounds like your time in Exeter was different, but very similar.
I tell you, we the discipline was quite. I mean, for you know, a subject that a lot of people would have written off as artsy fartsy, it was really disciplined. I mean, we had to show up every class. They didn't take a register, but they knew we were there because the classes were small. And we had to show up on time. And in fact, not just on time, but in time within special clothes they dictated that we wear to the practical classes anyway. And warming up, you know, that we were actually not just in the space, but we were actually warming up and getting ready to start. But I'll tell you something. I remember walking into Thornleigh, which was the main building where drama took place. I remember distinctly, I arrived there really nervous, went in first day, finding out what was what, you know, where I had to be or whatever. And I remember Professor Peter Thompson, the professor for drama. I remember my mum and dad had both been to university, and mum saying, oh, you must call him Professor Thompson, blah, blah, blah. But there was none of that. It was all first name stuff. But I remember Peter Thompson seeing me walking into the building, pointing his finger at me, saying, Oliver Double. Like, he knew my name. He knew my name. I mean, he might have just had a list with a photocopy and a sort of photo booth photo, and that's how he knew. And obviously, it wasn't a big student body; it was a tiny student body. But still, the fact that he knew my name and he was able to say it was really—I remember it all these years on, and that's a lot of years on.
Yeah, and I find with students here, if they know that you know who they are, then that does change the dynamics, because if they are absent, then they know that you know that they're not in the class. And I think it makes a difference. And also it feels less corporate. It also feels very personal. And if you're going to have a life-changing experience, I mean, you know, I had a life-changing experience at university, and in a way I never left. So I'd like my own students to at least have the opportunity to have the sort of thing that I did. Of course, it's up to them whether they have it or not, but at least the infrastructure needs to be in place, just as my tutors facilitated that all those years ago.
I think that it's really, really important that you can talk to students as you would anybody else. I'm really an anti-hierarchical person. A hierarchy is a fiction that helps us to organise things better, and if it doesn't, we shouldn't have it. I think that academics are quite hierarchical creatures. That's why people are so driven in terms of their promotion and that type of thing. I feel quite uncomfortable with unearned respect. If somebody talks to me just because I'm in the role that I am, in a way that they wouldn't somebody else, I don't feel very comfortable with that.
No, and I even find that in coffee shops, when somebody who's never met me before, or maybe actually somebody who serves me regularly, call me sir. I find that very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Well, why do you need to call me sir?
Yeah.
My students call me Chris.
Yeah.
You know, and actually it doesn't put me on. Of course, some people will like that. They like to be Mr. This or Dr. This or whatever. Yeah. But actually, no. From my point of view, in order to engage with somebody, in order to actually be a human being, you need to divest yourself of that sort of hierarchy.
I think we ought to see ourselves as we are, which is a community where everybody has a stake in that community, from fresher to professor. And we're all on the same journey. It's just we're in different parts of that journey. Sorry, I know that word has been completely harmed by its use on X Factor and Britain's Got Talent, but I mean it in the proper sense of, you know, moving from here to here. You know, I'm on a journey that I started in, I suppose, not, well, it depends on where you take it from, but if you talk about higher education, in 1983 when I started as a student, I'm on that. I wasn't in the same, it was not continuous. I went and did a different journey, and then I'm back on this journey now. And you know, what I'm doing when I'm writing a book is sort of the same as what a student's doing when they're writing an essay. It's just at a different level. That's all it is. And I think it's really helpful if we can get both sides of that equation to see things in that way. And it's really hard, and it's hard because on the academic side, a lot of us are a little bit, I don't want to say up ourselves, but we are. And then in terms of the student side, it's equally difficult because they see themselves now as customers. And I don't blame them for doing so. That's something that's been done to them by the extraordinarily levels of debt that's being inflicted on them. And it's really interesting to me that politicians who justify that and say, oh, well, they'll benefit in the long term, are people who had free education. They don't have to pay any fees. Yeah, as I did. And, you know, it seems to me it's fine to justify that. But just think of how you've benefited.
Yeah, there was a perverse argument a decade ago, well, not even a decade ago, 7 years ago, when it was said that because of the financial crash, which you mentioned earlier, the bankers had caused this crash, but the students will have to pay. And it was sort of like, well, it seems that the students, irrespective of whether they ought to pay for their education, are doing so because of what some, you know, I mean, it's like substitutionary atonement. It's the idea that somebody suffers on behalf of somebody, or an innocent person suffers on behalf of somebody else who's guilty. In court of law, you wouldn't feel very comfortable if, and of course this is the whole thing in Christianity with the atonement, but I mean this whole idea of somebody paying the price for somebody else's transgressions.
I mean, there's, you know, I mean, a lot of the people who caused the financial crisis have gone free and are thriving. There was an awful, I can't remember the exact statistic, but there was a statistic which I think Michael Meacher made a lot of that said the richest X percent, I mean, a small percentage of the British population had increased their wealth by the same amount that the economy as a whole had shrunk since the financial crisis. Those people, and actually a lot of those people, I've got to say, are the people pushing hardest for Brexit now. And it's interesting, I mean, we were talking about nostalgia. I mean, this is an interesting thing that I remember, going back to the thing about things I remember really vividly, I remember politicians really vividly. So I remember living in Park Row, Boston, and I remember knowing who all the leader party leaders were. I remember knowing it was Ted Heath, Harold Wilson, Jeremy Thorpe. Jeremy Thorpe, who we now have a very different understanding of. But I remember what their cartoons looked like. I remember what their posters looked like. I remember we had views over which parties we... I suppose it's because my parents must have talked about politics and we probably heard them talking about it. I've been interested in politics for a long time. And I remember kind of understanding concepts like socialism from, I'd say, probably 10, 12, maybe. I remember reading Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto for fun. I mean, in the sense of I hadn't been told to read it by a teacher at the age of about 16, 17. You know, these things were interesting to me. It's that thing, isn't it, to do with the changing fabric of life. You know, what was really interesting when they did the Hugh Grant sort of biopic. I mean, it's interesting because Hugh Grant looks nothing like Thorpe, but he kind of captured something. The makeup was kind of genius as well, and the hair. But he kind of he captured something of the man. And it's really weird. This is kind of distasteful. I hope I don't say anything dreadful here. The subject is distasteful. I don't think my view is. For me, there's a really difficult thing with the number of people who were around when we were growing up who have since turned out to be the most horrible, horrendous people. And I can see footage of Jimmy Savile and not be shocked, because to me, I'm remembering the Jimmy Savile that I knew before I knew that he was this monster, this terrible person. And there's lots more examples. It's really weird because, you know, one good aspect of this is a terrible thing to say, maybe, but one good aspect of those people being revealed for the monsters they are is that those lazy list shows have to be much more careful and have sort of disappeared from our screens. There was a time when pretty much all of Channel 4's output seemed to be celebrities talking about, oh, wasn't it really funny in the 80s when this happened? And then they show an archive clip, but they can't really show a lot of those things now because, oh no, Jimmy Savile, we have to take that out, you know, or whoever else.
Yeah, and this whole question of nostalgia, but we'll come to some more philosophically based questions in just a minute. Something I haven't asked you, which I meant to do, but the conversation has moved in all sorts of directions, but it was just either at childhood or at university, whether music or film had a particular influence on you. Obviously, comedy certainly did, but what about, I mean, for me, it was always the charts. What was in the charts when I was growing up, but did that sort of have an influence on you when you were younger?
Massively. I mean, massively. When I was growing up, when I first became aware of pop music, it would have been, going back to what we were just talking about, Gary Glitter would have been one of them. Alvin Stardust, Shawaddy Waddy, Mud. The first pop album I remember being in our house was my older brother got Mud Rock. I don't know if he got it for Christmas or something. Had his little name written on Biro on the back, you know, Mud Rock, which was, I think, their first studio album, possibly. And then I remember the direct pre-punk thing when it, to me, music seemed a bit boring. I mean, it wasn't the classic prog thing. There was a lot of kind of boring middle-of-the-road ballad-type music. And then when punk first started, I thought it was the most awful thing. I just, you know, I wasn't old enough to see through the kind of, you know, the shock horror headlines about it. They put a safety pin through their lip or whatever. But then I think my older siblings got into it a bit. And then that was another example of something that I found terrifying or distasteful and then got really into. So, I mean, I remember distinctly, actually. We probably don't think of there was a punk band now, but growing up in Lincoln, you know, this was kind of passably punk. My favourite band for a long time was the Boomtown Rats, right? And I remember the first time seeing them on Top of the Pops, it would have been their second single, Mary the Fourth Form. Oh, this is so weird. Look, his hair's a mess. Oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then the next single would have been She's So Modern. and his hair's, he's got more of it now and it's even messier. And then it would have been like clockwork. Oh, this is really dark lyrics. It's all about time passing and, you know, your life ebbing away in front of your own eyes. And his hair's even messier. And it's Rat Trap. Oh, this is really weird. The song goes all over the place and there's piano and he's...
And it references Top of the Pops, of course.
It does reference Top of the Pops. But by that point, it was like, oh, no, actually, I like this. This is my favourite thing. And actually with Rat Trap, when they got... Because they were the first punk or new wave band to get to number one. And they... Bob Gell... they tore up pictures of Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta. Right, that seemed so exciting, and then Bob Geldof pretended to play the sax part on a candlestick with lit candles in. One of them had gone out. You know, that's so punk. Like, one of the candles has gone out. They couldn't even get them all to be lit. Obviously, he's making fun of the fact they've got to mime. They're not allowed to play live. And so I remember that process, if you like. And then I got into, you know, more kind of, I suppose, The Clash and Stiff Little Fingers and these other slightly more kind of hardcore bands, the Sex Pistols. I came to them quite late. And then, you know, the bands that followed on from that, Dead Kennedys. And then other kinds of music as well. I really liked ska. I quite liked reggae because of the punk thing, the punk reggae crossover. I really like it now, but at that point I wasn't a huge fan, but I did like it. I really liked synth music as well, synthesizer music. There's kind of quite a big crossover between new wave.
Like OMD, would that come under
OMD,
that?
Yeah. I mean, Messages, that single, I could still remember the smell of the picture sleeve. It was on Dim Disc Records. I just think that's a perfect pop record. Even now, I could put that on. That will never not be one of my favourite songs. It's absolutely brilliant. The sound is just perfect. The lyric is sort of slightly ambiguous, you know, but the use of synthesizers. I mean, and what's interesting is that sometimes I kind of get, like, having left synth music behind in my teens, I don't know, maybe about 10 years ago, I started getting back into it again and started buying, collecting Kraftwerk albums and things like that. It's an amazing type of music. And of course, it's hugely influential as well, because you can spot the influence of 70s electronica and early 80s electronica in modern EDM, I think they call it, dance music, you know. So that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, growing up for me, I was 8 in 1981, but you know, Bad Manners, Tenpole Tudor, all...
Tenpole Tudor, people used to say I look like him, like Ed Tudorpole.
Ah, Swords of a Thousand Men.
Of a Thousand Men. Wunderbar, that was a great, great record. I mean, that was the thing. There was an amazing creativity that came just after punk, because in the wake of punk, you had movements like Two Tone, the mod revival, the new wave of heavy metal, synth music, new romantics. But also you had these one-offs, you know, like Tenpole Tudor. What the hell is that? They dress as knights and play this weird punk rockabilly hybrid.
Yeah, and although it was a completely different musical genre, for me you had Tenpole Tudor and Coast to Coast doing the Hucklebuck. Couldn't be more different, but fused in my imagination.
Yeah, well, it's about the same time. And it's interesting because it was like a rediscovery of styles that had gone. So
Jive in the 50s, yeah.
Yeah, so you had the rockabilly revival with Stray Cats and things, and then that morphed into psychobilly, you know. I mean, it's fascinating. There was a band, King Kurt, and they used to have a barber in the, you know, at their gigs, so you could have your hair cut into the same, you know, shaved off the side of your head, that kind of thing. I never saw Dead Kennedys. That's a really, so it's, you know, they were my favourite band for a long time, and I still think that a lot of their records are absolutely amazing. But I remember going for my interview to UEA. I didn't get an offer, but I remember my dad had driven me there, and there was a poster for Dead Kennedys there that night. I remember it was a picture, it was like a photocopy art thing with Reagan pushing a lawnmower through people, through humans, you know, mowing them down, that kind of thing. And I really regret that I just couldn't go, because my dad was due to take me back at 4 o'clock or whatever it was. And
I remember when I showed my parents Smash Hits magazine, and they...
Oh, I used to love Smash Hits.
And there was they printed the lyrics of a song, and it had SHIT in it. And I think, I was in about 7 or 8, they thought, you shouldn't be reading this. And you mentioned Dead Kennedys, which of course had Two Dunk Two, and we know.
Yes.
Look it up if anyone
chart hit. It's a chart hit.
Yeah.
They used to announce it as too drunk to, but there is another word.
It's like when...
Rhymes with truck.
Yeah. Well, it's like when Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds was made, and of course for the for breakfast TV they had to take out the second word.
Yeah.
So Inglourious is up for 10 Academy Award nominations.
Yeah.
It's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? And films, I mean, that's another example of something that I was always into films. I remember my dad. This is an interesting thing. People won't remember when a film had come out. It was often sent on to general release again sometime later. So I remember seeing Star Wars in the cinema when it first came out. People say Star Wars: A New Hope. No, the name of the film is Star Wars because that's exactly what it was called at the time. Anyway. I remember that, and then it came out like maybe a year and a half later, and they had the trailer for Empire Strikes Back, and I made my mum take me to see it. Not because I knew the trailer was going to be there, but just because I wanted to see it again. You know, it wouldn't be on telly for a while. It used to be at least 3 years till a film was on telly. But I also remember queuing in the rain to see Planet of the Apes on a double bill with Escape from the Planet of the Apes, which had been reissued on the back of the TV series, which was a hit. And we queued for so long that I missed all the early sequences of the movie, all the stuff in the spaceship, all the first walking across. We joined the story where they're in the kind of clearing with the gorillas come in on a horseback and start gathering people, gathering people in nets. That's where Planet of the Apes started for me because we've been queuing in the rain. Mm. I also remember my dad taking me to see two nights of James Bond double bills at the Lincoln Odeon, because I'd never seen a James Bond film at a cinema, but my older brother and sister had, and I felt like deprived. So my dad said, I'll take you to see, and I saw it would have been, the first one would have been You Only Live Twice, then Thunderball, and then Goldfinger would have been on the second night, and I can't remember what the other one would have been, but I think it was a Connery one. Mm. And people, the cinema was full. It wasn't a thing just for cinephiles, And then later, I got quite into horror films. Not a massive fan, but I was really keen on some of them. And that happened because I thought I'd never watch a horror film. I remember being in the cinema and seeing trailers for things like Exorcist 2 and going, that looks really frightening. I never will, never watch that. I will never watch that. I never watch anything like that. And I remember late at night when I'd been about 17 or 18, I think my mum would have gone to bed. And my older brother and sister were off at university. Perhaps my younger sister had gone to bed, I don't know. I was alone in the house, and I'd switched channel, right? And there was a film on. I thought, I'll watch this. And I didn't know what it was. And it was The Omen. And it had already started, so I didn't see the title sequence. And I just, I watched the whole thing and thought it was absolutely amazing. And it had Patrick Troughton in it, so that was a plus. And I just sort of went, wow. Because one of the things for me was, I was brought up in the Church of England. And the Church of England doesn't play the Satan card very hard, right? The Satan is kind of... I do remember actually being at Sunday school or something and somebody saying, if you do something bad, you're worshipping Satan. I remember that being quite an alarming concept. But generally speaking, Satan, certainly with my parents, they didn't really believe in that. They were like, that's a bit... It's just Halloween nonsense. And then so to see a film where the idea of Satan being a literal physical reality was very frightening, but brilliant,
Yeah, and I saw the remake of The Omen in 2006, and it was no patch on the remake. Even though it had Mia Farrow in it.
Oh, there we go.
From Rosemary's Baby, but no, it really was a very cheap and forgettable remake.
Another really powerful one was that you could see films cheap in the Cinema Society, CINSOC, at Exeter. Sin, obviously, like cinema as opposed to sin. So I used to go a lot, particularly in my first year, and I remember somebody, they had The Thing on, the John Carpenter film, and somebody said, it's really good, go and see it. And I was like, okay, it doesn't sound that great, but okay, I'll go and see it. I remember going to see it, and I actually had a really bad neck. I used to get very bad spinal problems because of bad posture, and I had a really bad neck, and and my neck was not just in pain, but it kept going to spasm. But of course, if you're tense, it's even worse. So all the way through the film, it's very frightening. Like, my neck is in agony. But I just thought it was an amazing film. For a start, the visual effects, it's sort of impossible to imagine the effects of that in the post CGI world. But they had CGI type effects, but created with rubber and stuff, and it looked real. You could tell that it wasn't, like, I remember watching things like Jason and the Argonauts and quite enjoying those films, but you always knew how they'd done it because somebody, an adult, would have explained, oh well, it's small models made out of rubber with wire inside, you know, like that toy you've got, and they move it bit by bit. I knew the concept of stop frame animation, and stop frame has a particular look. Yeah, even if it's brilliantly done, it has a particular look. But this was something I couldn't explain. Like, why is that dog's head that split open and it's coming out and it's still barking? How have they done that? And so there was that. There was the visual effects aspect, but also the I really like the John W. Campbell story, which I've since read, the novella, you know, that it's based on. That idea of being in a kind of confined space, not knowing who you could trust, and if you've got it wrong about that person, it has the most devastating consequences for you. I've long time harboured a fantasy about doing a live action interactive promenade show based on The Thing in the lower corridors at Elliott College with those low concrete ceilings. Like, I think it'd be amazing. I think you could do it. You'd have to put careful thought into how you did the visual effects, but I think you could do it by having things hidden behind benches and that kind of thing. I just think the claustrophobia of that building in the lower floors with the low concrete, it's very oppressive, low concrete ceilings, you know, I think that could work really well. I love that folklore, that kind of, it's like the urban legend thing, you know, that where it's really hard to work out who started this thing and how it spreads. But, I mean, for example, Mork and Mindy, I used to like Mork and Mindy. I know it was a really schmaltzy sitcom, but Robin Williams was just so brilliant in it. And I had, my wife grew up in the Potteries in Newcastle-under-Lyme, you know, Stoke-on-Trent. And she had heard the same rumour, the same completely false rumour about Mork and Mindy that I'd heard, which was that Robin Williams was dead. It's really weird. Like, well, how could we have... This is before the internet. Like, how could... But it's a bit like the Beatles, Paul is dead myth. You know, like, how do those things spread? Who invents them? How do they spread? It's weird. It's like internet-type things, but that existed before the internet.
No, and I find through being on Facebook with friends at university that we didn't have the internet back then, but... You can tell they haven't changed. It's just that the internet has now given scope for them to articulate whatever they want, disseminate what they want. But they were doing that sort of thing anyway. But we were just doing it in a pre-social media way through day-to-day, you know, interactions.
Yeah.
So we may be living, you know, in some cases in different countries. But you think authentically there is something about them. You know, it was almost as though if the internet hadn't been invented, somebody would have to have invented it. It's as though even before the internet, we were doing things that, you know, in a way, it is an extension. Or can be an extension of our own personality, which is why, back to what you were saying earlier about the way it can be abused by certain people with lots of money, then that's when it's malicious, because then it's almost sort of saying, well, we think you might like this, and it's moving people in the direction of how to vote in the election. So it becomes something something really quite subversive rather than a force for good, which in, you know, 9 times out of 10 it is.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I suppose that, you know, one of the things about the internet, I mean, apart from the manipulation aspect of it, obviously misogyny has always existed, but it's just like the internet has given misogyny rabies. You know, the people say, it's, in a way, it's a bit like, you know, when you're in your car, if somebody does something that's annoying on the road, you can swear because you know nobody can hear you. But people are sort of treating like the internet like it's the inside of their own car. Like, they feel like they can't be heard. There's no consequences to whatever they say, no matter how mean and vicious. And I feel quite strongly about that, really, because, you know, any woman in public life will have had online abuse, and that's horrible. Like, why is that acceptable? It's totally not, you know. And you know, I mean, that's. I mean, you could say the same thing of racism or, you know, prejudice against gay people or whatever it might be. I think the reason that misogyny kind of came to me as the first example was because it's just like, the thing is, you can be a racist, right? And but not actually. I mean, this is true, actually. I mean, there are racists out there who barely ever meet somebody who's of a different ethnic category to their own, right? But you can't not meet women. And you're walking around saying these things. I'm not saying it's work. It's just it strikes me as more striking just because of that. These people who are writing hate and rape threats are going home and ringing their mum. Do you know what I mean? Like, to me, that's just terrifying.
No. And I think the number of people who enter public life who, it turns out, 5 or 10 years earlier had posted something racist or misogynistic or just downright stupid, which you know, disqualifies them for the office that they're seeking. And you're absolutely right. It should be a corrective. That, I mean, I'm someone who sometimes puts out, you know, a different side of my persona. Sometimes a cheeky, more maybe a more ironic sort of side to what I might come out with when I'm with my students, for example. But all the same, I'm conscious that if anything's going out there, I have to be comfortable that no one's going to then say in 5 years' time, "Gosh, you know, because he posted that, therefore we must get rid of him." So I think you're right, and I think that sense of perspective, rather than a knee-jerk reaction. Yeah. Because people, there will always be somebody who'll be offended by something that somebody meant in a light-hearted spirit.
And I think as well, I think there's that. I mean, I think a lot of people, a lot of comedians talk about how, you know, people just won't, people don't recognise comic irony or any basic comic structure online. They're just prepared to sort of monster and condemn. That's the other side of it. Is there, there's this sort of high-handed kind of, you know, kind of morally superior, oh, you know, you're a terrible person because you used the wrong word for this or whatever.
And targeting it at an individual rather than a character.
Yes, quite. And then the other thing about it is that I suppose in a way what the internet does is it allows a space with which people can kind of display aspects of themselves, and sometimes it's the worst aspects, and then they can become emboldened by what other people say. So one of the things that's really frightened me since Brexit, and, you know, I have to say I'm becoming increasingly aware of the fact that our black students don't always have an easy time because they come to Canterbury, which is hasn't got a big black population apart from the student population, and they get, even if it's just like funny looks, they get that a lot. And if you come from a part of London where it's just perfectly accepted that people are, you know, people basically behave like people should, they accept that people are of different colours and different ethnicities and what have you, but I wish there was something I could do about that. I don't think it's right that black students should put up with that. It's just awful. But, you know, since Brexit, racists have become emboldened. The thing about it is, right, there's this argument. You don't have to be a racist to be concerned about immigration. You don't, but it helps, right? You don't have to be a racist to vote for Brexit. No, but it helps. It helps you to vote Brexit if you're racist. A lot. What I think of racism, right, here's an interesting thing. It links us back to nostalgia, right? So when we were growing up, right, you'd see an interview maybe, or you'd see, you know, a drama, and people would be smoking. So somebody smoking a cigarette being interviewed by Parkinson, or somebody smoking a cigarette on a soap opera or something like that. It's just normal, you know, it'd just be normal thing to see somebody smoking. Or you'd see, I don't know, a footage of a band playing live and somebody smoking as they're playing or whatever. And then what happened was, because of concerns about the health aspects of tobacco, for very good reasons, now if somebody smokes on EastEnders, it's because it's going to be a storyline where they're going to get cancer or something. It's like EastEnders is not a realistic world. It's a world where smoking doesn't really exist, right? But the same is also true of racism. Casual racism exists in the world, and it always has. But for good reasons, they didn't want to show people being casually racist because they didn't want to encourage that. But in a way, what they were doing was kidding us into thinking that racism had gone away. And a lot of white people could go, oh, well, why are they getting so worried about things? Because I don't see any evidence of this. No, because nobody's being racist to you, you idiot. Of course you don't. Nobody's going to call you, you know, some horrible racial slur, because, you know, aimed at black people, because you're not black, you idiot. You know, just because you don't see it on EastEnders doesn't mean to say it's not happening. And it's like, it's not that it would never be seen, but if when we were growing up, and I'm not going to defend it, but racism, racial slurs would be used in light comedy, you know, and that's not a good thing. It's good that stopped.
Well, I went to a Jim Davidson gig, and I was aware that I was completely atypical, not least because it was very clear that in terms of what he was saying on the stage and referring to people like, you know, university types who read The Guardian. And I was thinking, I was only about four rows from the front. I was thinking, please don't look at me. But it was all white. And a certain, and there was something, of course, I was trying to work out, he's undoubtedly a very clever man, but I was trying to work out, is he is this who he really is? And I think it is. Or is he just playing to the gallery? Because, of course, he was the face of Saturday Night TV.
Yeah.
He is the guy who did that Big Break and the Generation
yes.
Game. And now he's... he always did that sort of... I know somebody who saw him on stage decades ago when he was still on yeah. television. But of course, now he doesn't... He's not invited on television, and he's yeah. almost like playing on that.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of wondering whether this is just he's found a niche in the market. But fascinating, because I was sitting around among people, and I just thought, you know, I kind of would be glad to leave. I'm glad I went to the show, but it actually kind of confirmed some of my worst prejudices. He was very funny, but he was saying things that I wouldn't dream of saying. But part of me admired him, but also part of me also was appalled, not so much that he was saying it, but of the way that some of the people might have taken that, because they struck me as a quite, in lots of ways, a conservative audience.
Yes, I've seen Jim Davison. When I was researching my second stand-up book, I went to see him at Theatre Royal Margate, and a similar sort of experience. I was actually on the front row, and I was really relieved that he didn't talk to me. Interestingly, I actually think that he is a very talented comic, and I actually think that he's way more talented than Manning was, or any of those other kind of like comedians. And why I think he's more talented is because Manning basically just told jokes, just old gags. Almost everything he said on stage was that, or, you know, just circumstantial stuff, you know, interactional stuff. The vast majority of what he did was. Jim Davison does proper stand-up routines, like routines about a thing, about a subject. And this show even had like a concept. It was quite like the modern style of conceptual stand-up show. It's called Vote for Jim. And the conceit was that he was going to set up a political party with Jethro, you know, as the Chancellor of the Exchequer or whatever. And that it was, you know, not going to be any of these old dreadful old politicians. And weirdly, I'm pretty sure that the made-up colours of his party were purple and possibly even purple and yellow, i.e.
UKIP.
What became UKIP's colours. And I remember thinking, this is brilliant, but it's so horrible. He's so misogynistic. And although he's claimed not to be racist, what else could you call that weird voice that he did for his made-up black friend, Chalky? Right, here's the thing, right? I'm not doing a racial impersonation now, but Chalky, you sort of talk like this. Like, what is that voice? Nobody in the world talks like that. Fozzie Bear, possibly. It sounds more like Fozzie Bear than it sounds like any human. Why did anybody find that funny? It's so weird. It's such a weird thing. Like, let's just take away the kind of ethics and the racism, you know, what the racial politics of the That's weird. Like, nobody talks like that. It's not based on observation. It's such an odd thing. And it was accepted, and as you say, on mainstream television, Tiz was. He used to appear on the children's programme. Tiz was. Sometimes we used to have people like Jim Davison doing that voice. What the hell were they thinking? Mm. There's quite an interesting thing that all of popular entertainers of that era, even some of the ones probably who've been outed now as these dreadful monsters, raise money for charity. It was the big thing, and they were always apolitical charity, so it was sick kids, that kind of thing. Mm. You know, things that you couldn't argue against. They're just you know, good causes. That was always the case, and then they would almost always vote conservative as well, mainly for tax purposes, but also I suppose the respectability that came with that. You can trace that trend back to the music hall. You know, a lot of those people came from quite humble backgrounds but became Tories because of their success. But what happened with alternative comedy was actually a different thing, because they kind of, you know, they didn't pretend to be jolly entertainers. They were quite aggressive, a lot of them. But the money they raised would be for causes which those other people wouldn't have raised money for, like Amnesty International, for example, or Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, that kind of thing. Much more political charities. And actually, there was less of a disjuncture between the horrible things they were saying and then the good works they were doing. Because, you know, if you go out there and describe yourself as being an anarchist or a Marxist and then you raise money for Amnesty or, you know, CND, do you know what I mean? That sort of fits.
Absolutely it fits. Whereas here, it was about people who've been in the armed forces, have gone to prison, and he's sort of like saying, well, you know, they did a lot for their country, but yeah, they've done some stupid things maybe afterwards, but we need to support them because of all the great things they did for their country, and maybe they've got PTSD, and we need to make sure that, you know, that there's, you know, the government is not paying for them, therefore, you know, this charity will help them. So you can't deny the cause, but also you sort of think, well, yeah, but 10 seconds ago he was being racist and misogynistic, so it kind of feels that it's sort of there's lots of things going on at the same time.
I think as well that, to be fair, that with Jim Davison there isn't a complete disjuncture between, because on stage he's very right wing, and then but part of his politics is driven by patriotism, and part of his patriotism is support for the armed services. So there is a kind of logic to it, actually. What's interesting about that is, in terms of the broader sweep of history, I mean, you know, there's that thing recently where soldiers were on social media having their photo taken with Tommy Robinson. Mm. There is, the general assumption is that if you're in the armed forces, you're going to be from the political right. But that hasn't always necessarily been the case. For example, it's largely believed, at least there's a widely believed theory, that one of the reasons that Attlee was elected in 45 with this reforming Labour government that set up the NHS and so on, was because soldiers were given, as part of their training, so that they felt an investment in winning the war, political discussion, and it raised consciousness. And there were a lot of ex-servicemen who supported Labour and voted them to victory. So it hasn't always necessarily been the case that the army's been right-wing. But now the assumption is, in a way it's a bit like how the right have co-opted patriotism and gone, well, if you like your country, then you like us, and you hate foreigners and stuff. But that's bullshit. You know, one of the things that makes me proud to be British is the fact that we love curry, and the fact that we're multicultural, and the fact that reggae thrived here, and dub poetry thrived here, and you know, the fact that we've welcomed Eastern European. I mean, I grew up in Lincoln. Actually, in terms of ethnic diversity, it wasn't brilliantly ethnic diverse. There are a few black families, you know, who sent kids to our school, some Chinese families, that kind of thing. But there were quite a lot of Eastern Europeans. You know, there was a Polish club, I think there was a Ukrainian club. And, you know, the fact that we've welcomed these people, I mean, obviously they haven't exclusively been welcomed, that's the problem. But, the broad mass of the population has accepted and adapted. To me, that's a good thing. That's the good thing about our country, you know, that we've been cosmopolitan, that we've accepted and changed and adapted and welcomed the best parts of Britain has, you know. And that's what makes me so sad about things like UKIP and the rise of that, because it's the worst aspects. You know, I've read books for a personal interest rather than a bit for research I can't remember the name of it now. Mass Observation. Mass Observation Project, so Mass Observation Diaries from the post-war period. And it's horrific. The level of racism is horrific, not just against black people, because there weren't, you know, it was this pre, well, just about the time of Windrush, but against Jewish people. Like, you kind of go, were you not paying attention to what just happened here? But, you know, people say, even people who identify as being on the left at that time were saying the most horrifically anti-Semitic things. And go back, it's quite interesting, actually, how Israel was seen at the time. Go back and look at news headlines about how Jewish people fighting for the state of Israel, you know, for the foundation of the state of Israel, they were treated as terrorists. And you'd have headlines like, Jews warned, things like that. Like, it's so weird that that's been kind of forgotten about in terms of, especially given how anti-Semitism is a really live and important issue now. Why aren't we seeing it in terms of the broader sweep? Why aren't we seeing that Britain fought against the Nazis, but also a lot of British people hated Jewish people? That's been kind of airbrushed out of history. That's really weird to me. Mm. I've always found anti-Semitism one of the weirdest forms of prejudice, because you have to have knowledge to be able to practice it.
And I feel that sometimes when I'm talking about or researching nostalgia, that it's often bound up with a peculiarly right-wing ideology, certainly in terms of what Trump is doing, make America great again, but also in terms of the Brexit debate.
Yeah.
That and I'm very much left of centre, but of course I suppose I'm studying nostalgia perhaps in a different way. I suppose it's more that I'm fascinated about what it is about the past that galvanises people, rather than necessarily saying a particular period was amazing because...
For me, I think what's interesting about nostalgia is that it's... I've mentioned things that kind of sort of trigger feelings of the past, like, you know, I don't know, album covers or whatever. But one of the things that's interesting is sometimes you go, why do I remember that? It didn't seem that important at the time, but I remember it really well now. And I'll tell you one thing I do remember is, I remember I used to go to Cubs. I was a Cub Scout up until the age of 9. When we moved to Lincoln, we didn't find another pack for me to go to. I'd gone to the same one my brother went to. And it wasn't my favourite thing, but I remember quite enjoying it. But I do remember an American boy came to join our pack for a bit. And he was Jewish, and it was probably quite unusual being... I mean, there were Jewish people in Boston, but, you know, probably not that many. And his parents came in to do a shadow puppet show about Hanukkah, and I'd never heard of Hanukkah. and they gave us Hanukkah biscuits, and I thought it was just so cool. I loved it. Like, biscuits, great. And they were going, Hanukkah lasts more than one day, and you get a gift every day or whatever. Wow, yeah, why don't we have Hanukkah? It's great. And then they had the shadow puppets, which I don't think I'd ever seen before. It was just absolutely fantastic. And I remember him explaining as well how the Cubs in America had different badge systems or something, you know. So it was, you know, it's funny how those things stick with you. And I think that with that was quite, probably quite important for me, in formative thing, you know, in terms of, I don't really like the word tolerance, because I think that tolerance implies, well, I don't like you much, but I'll put up with you. I prefer, I don't know, acceptance or joy or enthusiasm, that kind of thing. But enthusiasm for difference, I think, probably started with things like that.
Yeah. I've got one last question for you. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Okay, that's a very interesting question. And it is actually something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, because I turned 50 like 3.5 years ago. And obviously it's a milestone birthday. I didn't have a freak out about it. It was fine. Although I had just had a major injury. So it did make me, I suppose I was thinking about things a bit. But one of the things is, you can get to a point in life where you kind of go, everything that's really cool has already happened, and anything that happens from now might be okay, but it's not going to be as good as things that have happened before. And also that, you know, things are going to get worse from here on in, that kind of feeling, or it's just going to be more of the same. And actually what I've been doing as a kind of conscious thing is going, no, it doesn't have to be like that. You know, you can do things. You can do things that are different, and you don't know what's around the corner. Something really cool might happen. And actually what's quite interesting is, since that happened, I've had things like being invited to do a keynote in the States, you know, being taken over earlier this year to do an incredibly cool event with comedians and academics who think about comedy in Denmark, you know, which I'd never visited before. So I think I try to be a look forward person. I'll tell you though, there is an interesting thing. You were talking about films and music earlier. Like, I don't want to be one of those people who goes, no good music has been produced after 2010 or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, you pick the year depending on your age. Music was okay up to this point, and no popular music produced after this point is any good. It's
very much 1990.
All right, there we go. So I've tried to keep in touch. I've tried to find music that's from now that I like. But it's getting really hard because so much music now is bad. And the thing is, you might go, well, that's just a function of age. Well, you're in your 50s. It's not aimed at you. Fine. That is true. But in addition to that, the way that music is produced is different. It's different. It's much more marketized. Whereas if you think about somebody like the Human League, whatever you think about the Human League, I'm a fan of their early work. When they started out, they were properly art house. You know, they were making records about the exploitation of silkworms in the production of silk, or, you know, I don't know, a kind of sci-fi circus that's taking over the world, or a record, an LP record that could take over the universe. Like, really weird things, and pioneering, you know, the use of synthesizers. And then they went, oh, well, we want to be the electronic ABBA. And they started writing pop records, but still pioneering the use of synthesizers. And they were just Sheffield blokes who'd been to art school, and then Sheffield women, when the Suzanne and...
Oh, Joanne Catterall.
Yeah.
Where has that come from? That come from 1981.
Well, apparently Phil Oakey met them at a club called The Limit, where I used to go when I was doing my postgrad at Sheffield. So, which is a very fun club, but perhaps not get into that. But anyway, the point is that only people could make music and be very successful with creative ambition. I think it's become much harder to do that now because of the ruthless marketization. It's like a casting process now. Rather than it being, this is my thing, I created this, it's like, well, you can make our product, we'll get somebody to write for you, we'll get somebody to take your photo, you know, you could be the blandest shit imaginable and it's fine, we'll sell lots and lots of downloads for you.
And very apt now, of course, because it was also the first album I ever bought, or shared it with my sister, Dare.
Yeah.
There we are, absolutely. I've seen it now in a completely different light.
Yeah, well, Dare was an amazing record. I mean, it really was. I mean, pioneering the use of, I think, the Lindrum, you know, this at the time groundbreaking rhythm machine, you know, it's Yeah, it's a pop record, an unashamed pop record that does songs about the Kennedy assassination and Judge Dredd and telling the story of A Star Is Born in a 4-minute pop song. Using a Casio VL tone, this sort of essentially a glorified electronic. I've got one of those, by the way, which I've had since 1982. You know, and really, really imaginative, brilliant record that was also a huge hit. I think we've forgotten that things that are very popular can also be very good. I mean, the Beatles is an excellent example. I remember being aware of the Beatles as a very small child, and I remember being told they'd split up and finding that a bit upsetting. You know, they were the most popular band and the best, you know.
Ollie Double, this has been so amazing. I had so many more questions, but I think you've probably answered them. Thank you very much. This has been an amazing interview.
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks.